Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Which one does not belong? Iranian hackers indicted for taking over Bank of America computers, New York Stock Exchange computers, AT&T computers, and a small neighborhood dam in a quiet suburb in Westchester. Here's United States Attorney General Loretta Lynch on the banking hacks.
These attacks were relentless, they were systematic, and they were widespread. They threatened our economic well-being and our ability to compete fairly in the global marketplace.
And here's U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara on the dam.
Although no actual harm resulted from that infiltration, the potential havoc that such a hack of American infrastructure could wreak is scary to think about.
Scary because, in theory at least, the alleged hacker, Hamid Farouzi, working from his computer in Iran, could have manipulated water levels at the Bowman Street Dam in the city of Rye Brook and caused the flooding of homes and other structures below the Blind Brook. It's those water levels that the dam controls. What the relationship is between that and locking hundreds of thousands of Americans out of their bank accounts remains a mystery. Let's see if we can figure it out. First, with Fred Kaplan, Slate's War Stories columnist and author of the new book, Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War, and Ellen Nakashima, who covers national security for The Washington Post. Fred, welcome back. Ellen, welcome to WNYC.
Good to be with you.
Thanks.
And we'll get to the dam, but let's begin with the big picture. Ellen, these were DDoS, or distributed denial of service attacks, in 2011 and 2012. Can you remind us of what distributed denial of service means?
Right. Those are basically when the attacker commandeers or takes over a large number of computers or computer servers, unbeknownst to their owners, and uses those to direct large amounts, barrages of digital traffic at target or victim computers, and essentially overwhelms them, their servers, with traffic and causing them to crash.
From what's been reported or released in the indictment, Fred, how much service was actually denied?
Well, apparently everything, and in a small number of banks for a number of hours, I think maybe in a couple of cases days. Banks have gotten quite good at handling this sort of thing, at least compared with other types of industry, but their methods are still not foolproof. You can, if something can be hacked into, someone will do it.
Ellen, the New York Times article on this today suggests that this was retaliation by Iran for the U.S. unleashing the so-called Stuxnet virus on Iran's main nuclear enrichment plant a few years earlier. So we started it?
Well, that may be one element of it as well, but intelligence officials at the time also said they believed that this was in retaliation for Western sanctions against Iran imposed to try to curtail Iran's nuclear program. So there was a lot going on at the time geopolitically that kind of factored into, we think, the DDoS attacks.
And it's being reported that the suspects are computer specialists who regularly worked for the elite military unit called the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, but that the indictment stopped short of naming the Iranian government itself. Ellen, would that stopping short likely be a political decision or a legal one or something else, as far as you could tell?
Well, the IRGC is essentially an arm of the government. It's part of the military, the elite military that's responsible for internal security, guarding the security and protecting sort of the Islamic state and promoting its ideology. So it is essentially accusing the government.
And listeners, if you have questions about these indictments on alleged Iranian hackers into U.S. banks and a dam in Westchester, which we will get to with the county executive, Rob Astorino, in a couple of minutes, you can call in 212-433-WNYC, 433 9692. And for that matter, anybody who lives near this Bowman Dam in Rybrook and wants to just kind of set the scene for us or tell us your reaction to hearing this somehow caught up in international espionage, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Fred, it sounds like these attacks cost some money and inconvenience, but no major damage. So from what you can tell, could the hackers have done much worse damage if they had wanted to? Like maybe this was some kind of warning or practice run?
Well, as I understand it, they were able to hack into sort of the front office of the dam, but not the operational system. In other words, not the computers that control the flow of water into or out of the dam. So whether that was because they didn't want to or whether because they couldn't, is something that I don't know. But,
yeah.
You know, there's
but
a, there's
same
a
question.
Well,
I was just going to ask same question with respect to the banks, if they could have caused a lot more damage there. But then go on to your larger point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what they did was quite a lot of damage. But here's my – I don't – and again, I'm open to argument here, but I don't really quite see the point of these lawsuits. It's not like anybody's going to get extradited and hauled through the courts in the United States. As a deterrent, I don't know. You know, I think I felt the same way when the Justice Department indicted the Chinese hackers and North Korea. I don't see how this is a deterrent to further hacking. I don't see how it shames anyone. I was talking with someone just the other day who used to be one of the elite hackers for the National Security Agency. And I said, if a foreign government indicted you and slapped your name on a wall and you know, said you hacked into some network of theirs and they're indicting you, well, would that shame you or would people take you out to lunch? And he said, probably people would take me out to lunch. So I don't quite, and this goes on, it's not like this happens rarely. This kind of thing happens hundreds of times a day, and so I'm really not quite sure what the point of this is.
Ellen, you want to get in on this?
Yeah, I certainly hear that point of view, but it's also interesting that with the following the indictment of the five Chinese military officers, the People's Liberation Army officers in 2014. Intelligence analysts began to notice a distinct sort of drop in the level of activity coming from the PLA, hacking activity coming from the PLA against U.S. targets and banks. And they noticed this sort of decline in activity for a while. However, at the same time, apparently another branch of the Chinese government, the Ministry of Internal Security, MOIS, began sort of raising its level of hacking activity. So on the one hand, sort of the PLA side went down, but the other arm went up. Nonetheless, these government officials felt that the indictments, as well as sort of the, there had been an earlier report put out by a company called Mandiant that caused a lot of concern. It got, you know, global headlines, and it was the first report that really named or called out publicly this particular hacking unit of the PLA and sort of went into their actual names and some of their tactics, describing them. All of that got a lot of attention, then followed up by these indictments. It seemed to have this effect of causing the PLA hacking activity to decline. Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Forgive me. We had an unrelated technical problem to you, Alan. Keep going.
So there seemed to be some connection or some impact from the, you know, public naming through the indictment and the Mandiant report. But as I said, on the other hand, you know, the activity kind of picked up from the other arm of the government. So at this point, the intelligence community is still taking a wait-and-see attitude toward the actual impact of the indictment and whether or not this.
So there could be, in some respects, you're saying, something to be gained by publicizing the names of these Iranians, even if there's no chance of getting them extradited to the United States to stand trial?
Yes, and perhaps an even more significant element of that is last year the Obama administration created a new program of economic sanctions for cyber, for malicious cyber acts. And I reported in last September, I guess it was, the administration was actually preparing a package of economic sanctions to impose on Chinese individuals who were connected to hacking, and economic espionage in cyberspace. That sort of public announcement or news had, the apparent effect of causing great alarm in Beijing, and they rushed over a high-level delegation to the United States to start talking to administration officials here, and eventually, negotiated sort of a compromise, and which resulted in President Xi Jinping of China in the Rose Garden saying that, China would not conduct economic espionage in cyberspace. Now, whether or not he can, make good on his pledge and whether China will actually desist in that remains to be seen. But it was an unprecedented step by a Chinese, president who up until, just recently, until that point, China's stand had been, we don't do these things. We don't hack. We don't conduct economic espionage. We're the victims.
Fred, want to keep going on this?
Yeah, that's true. What Ellen is saying, that there is some precedent for this. Years ago, when the Russians were first caught hacking into Defense Department networks through a server at the Russian Academy of Sciences, they stopped for a little while, and then it started in again, actually in a slightly more sophisticated manner, through other servers. But what Ellen said about the follow-up of sanctions, if we do that with these Iranians, it could have an impact, but I would caution in one way. We do a lot of hacking as well, and it's a different sort of hacking. We're not hacking into Chinese or Russian banks. We don't really need to do that. We're not stealing trade secrets, but we are hacking into other countries' infrastructures, their military networks. And, when a few years ago, when the Obama administration, when the White House itself, starting with the National Security Advisor at the time, Tom Donilon, started calling out the Chinese publicly for their hacking and saying that this, was tantamount to warlike activities and we were going to take this very seriously, there were some high-ranking officials in the Defense Department who are a little alarmed and a little leery because they thought, we do some of this ourselves, and are you creating a situation where you're just asking for someone to call us out on hypocrisy?
An escalation of a cyber war as well?
Yeah, because, again, we don't go into banks or private industry, but we do go into military
governments,
networks.
Right.
We go into their critical infrastructure of their industries. It's a common endeavor. So to pretend that this is something that's unique and for which we are solely the victim
can backfire.
Yeah.
We're talking. Go ahead,
saw
Ellen.
That, you saw that sort of interesting conflict in the Office of Personnel Management hack, the big OPM hack that was sort of disclosed last year, in which the personnel files and the classified clearance information of thousands of U.S. government employees and sometimes their families and friends was hacked into by the Chinese. And there was great outrage and great alarm, but you did hear some, the intelligence officials saying, wait a minute, this is actually what we consider sort of political spying or political espionage, not hacking for commercial benefit. It wasn't, after all, the Chinese getting social security numbers and credit card numbers to go steal, sell on the black market. I think it was Mike Hayden, the former head of the CIA, who said, good on them. If I had had that opportunity, I would have done it myself when I was head of the NSA, and I wouldn't have even called downtown to ask permission. But, you know, on the other hand, it was a great wake-up call to the U.S., and there were lawmakers who were calling for, you know, for some sanctions or punishment on the Chinese because of it.
We're talking about the indictments of seven Iranians on cyber attacks against dozens of major U.S. banks. If you were locked out of your online banking account in 2011 or 2012, this may have been why. And also against a small dam in Rybrook in Westchester, the computer system there. Our guests continue to be Ellen Nakashima, who covers national security for The Washington Post, and Fred Kaplan from Slate. But also joining us now to talk about the dam is the Westchester County Executive, Rob Astorino. County Executive, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Your old friend, Brian. How are you?
Okay. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear from you.
So apparently the dam's computer system was offline for maintenance at the time, so the hacker could not actually have controlled the water level and flooded the neighborhood. But why was this neighborhood dam a target along with major U.S. banks and AT&T? Is it clear to you?
No, it's not clear to us. I think my first reaction a few months ago is one that other elected officials, especially local elected officials, should have, in that the federal government, Homeland Security in this instance, never alerted us to this in any way, shape, or form when they found out in August and September of 2013. Now, we're in a unique position here because Westchester County sits on the Joint Terrorist Task Force. And the Joint Terrorism Task Force, as well as we are in a counterterrorism zone. So we have worked very closely with the NYPD. We have really high visible, highly targeted infrastructure. We have the Kensico Dam, which is 32 billion gallons of water behind it for New York City, as well as a nuclear power plant, schools, universities, train lines, you name it. And the fact that this one particular dam was, in the grand scheme of things, Brian, it's kind of inconsequential. You know, it was not going to do any major damage if they controlled the sluice gate and thus the water levels. However, the fact that somebody, you know, thousands and thousands of miles away in another continent could get into the system is, in my estimation, potentially a run-up to testing what they could potentially do at a future date, which could be an air traffic control tower, a nuclear power plant, a much bigger dam, whatever, the grid. That's the scary part. Mm-hmm. But here, it doesn't matter what political parties you are or how you feel about people individually. We all need to work together. We've got a common enemy here. And the FBI apparently was not even told, because they would have had that information, and we would have all had that on the JTTF. The FBI wasn't even told by Homeland Security.
Yeah, so Ellen, let me get your take on that. As a reporter on national security from Washington, if all these pieces of, you know, non-sharing of information that are coming out are true, they told the city officials in Rybrook, didn't tell the county executive, Rob Astorino, didn't tell the state, and now county executive is saying that they didn't share information, you know, in the different departments of the federal government. Do you know this to be true, and why would that be the case?
No, I do not have that level of you know, visibility into the information sharing or lack thereof regarding the dam. But I do know that that has been a problem for the federal government. They've been trying for years to fix it, you know, setting up an operational center in the at DHS, and now also creating a new cyber threat intel, sort of like the NTIC in Washington, D.C. But I'm not sure that it's...
Fred, anything on that?
Yeah, I would say there are two problems here. One, it's the Department of Homeland Security that's tasked with the business of coordinating federal response to this sort of thing. They really are not set up to do this. It's a pretty dysfunctional organization. Second, about 20 years ago, when these kinds of attacks came known, there were people in the White House who tried to impose mandatory cybersecurity standards on critical infrastructure industries. And these were resisted both by the industries and by people in the White House, like economic advisors who feared that it would retard research and development and make American industry non-competitive. And so even executive orders that have been signed by President Obama recently, there's always a line in there which says nothing in this order should be interpreted to mean a mandatory regulation. So this is going to keep happening because there is not a coordinated process for dealing with it, at least outside the military.
Sounds like
and,
Europe.
These companies don't have to do what they and it's in many ways not economically cost effective for each of these industries to do much about it.
County Executive, can you just describe this dam and the area it's in? Do you know it?
Yeah, I do know it, and it is relatively remote. It is a brook behind it. So, again, the water levels are not going to be so high where it's going to do a lot of damage, but that's not the point. The point is they were able to get into a system remotely, and I strongly believe, and I know that others in the federal government, including the FBI, feel very strongly that this was to test to see whether they could do it on a much larger scale. The fact that in August and September of 2013, this so alerted the federal government in Homeland Security that they took this, again, a fairly inconsequential remote dam, they took what happened and went all the way to the White House to give them a briefing and an alert. And that we, who would have to respond, God forbid something terrible did happen, again, not necessarily with this particular dam, but that we were not giving a heads up, and that we sit so close to New York City and, in fact, work in conjunction with the NYPD and the federal authorities on the Joint Terrorism Task Force, it's almost inconceivable after 9/11 where agencies never worked together. The communication between these agencies was nil because everyone wanted to be the lead agency and not share. That the one thing we've learned from 9/11 is that these agencies must communicate with each other because whether it's a federal agency or a local police department, everyone has to share in dealing with the war on terror.
And unfortunately, we're learning the same thing again from Europe this week.
Right, exactly.
But what about the city officials of Rye Brook who were told? Would you have expected them to notify you as county executive or notify the state?
No, what they were told, the city of Rye actually was told, there was an inquiry made to the city of Rye from some obscure bureau within Homeland Security that nobody's ever heard of. I certainly didn't hear of it either. And so they wanted to know what the issue was, and they were told in very generic terms that there might have been something, and they just wanted a little more information.
Mm-hmm.
So even they had no idea what the real request was or what the investigation was. Now, the good thing since then was the FBI, which they were not at fault in this. It was Homeland Security. But the FBI and Westchester County in particular have met several times. I got a call on Tuesday about what was going on in Belgium, but also about the impending indictments that happened yesterday. And we are in better communication. And the FBI is actually going to work. They have an office in White Plains, a field office. They're going to work with us on some other initiatives that we're going to roll out in the coming months that I think will help the private sector sort of beware of what could happen in their own systems and how we have to stay ahead of that.
All right. County Executive from Westchester, Rob Astorino, thanks for giving us a few minutes. And we continue with Ellen Nakashima, National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post, and Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate and is author of the new book, very relevant, Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Now, in a related story, the FBI made news this week by withdrawing its court case against Apple, seeking the company's help in getting into the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone data, which was protected by standard iPhone encryption. The FBI has apparently decided it can hack the phone itself. Now, interestingly, when I interviewed Edward Snowden 2 weeks ago, He seemed like something of an outlier at that time for suggesting the government didn't need to take Apple to court because the government really has the capacity to hack the phone itself. Here's part of what Snowden said to me and the audience at BAM on March 11th.
The FBI alleged they have the exclusive, or that Apple has the exclusive technical means for getting into this phone. That's simply false. There is no credible technologist who focuses on these issues, who specializes in this, who believes that is the case. There are literally commercial companies, groups like there's one named Chipworks, who literally their entire line of business is this kind of operation where you derive the secret from the hardware device. This would be the same kind of encryption key that's used for example, protecting pay for cable streams and like TV boxes or providing copyright protection on video game consoles and things like that. There's a huge industry dedicated to this. So for the FBI to say, we can't get into this phone if Apple doesn't help us, that's simply not true.
Edward Snowden via video link from Russia in my interview with him as part of Radio Love Fest 2 weeks ago, presented by WNYC and BAM. So, Fred Kaplan, do you agree with Snowden that a whole industry exists that the government could have tapped at any time to accomplish this task?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I am a little startled, though, that Edward Snowden is advocating a position where the government should routinely call on professional hackers to contravene in private networks. But it's not the FBI that found a way to do it itself. The FBI probably cannot, but the NSA could, but that would require circumventing some legal procedures. Believe it or not, the NSA actually takes quite seriously. In this case, again, you know, you've got the situation where the FBI says, oh, we can't break into the system. And you have Apple saying, we have the most secure systems in the world, and the slightest compromise will kill our whole industry. So you do have dozens of companies, but all they do, Ed Snowden is right, is look for what they call zero-day exploits, vulnerabilities in operating systems that nobody has discovered before. And they're rewarded by many companies even, except Apple, for coming up with this. You know, Google has announced, if you can break into our source code, we will give you $100,000, because they would rather have some private company doing it and showing where the thing was vulnerable and how to patch it than to wait for the Chinese to hack them again.
So Ellen, Snowden's assertion, or extrapolating from what he and Laura Poitras, the filmmaker who was also there with me talking about this, extrapolating from what they said as critics of the surveillance state, would basically be that the government knew it could do this all along, but really wanted to set the legal precedent that when the usually compliant tech industry wants to show some signs of independence from the intelligence agencies, the state will smack them down in court and win. Do you agree that that's what the lawsuit was about? Is there evidence of that?
I think what the government was trying to do is certainly, you know, obtain what in effect would be a type of precedent that they could use to, in future, try to continue to force other companies to help them in their criminal and terrorism investigations, you know, surveillance and unlocking phones. They've been blocked so far because of sort of a standoff where, you know, the law goes only so far. There are technical assistance provisions in the Wiretap Act and the FISA, and but no court has ever interpreted to mean that it should force a company to actually, you know, break its own encryption or create code that would have that effect. And so there's been this standoff.
And there's more backlash, or there has been more backlash, maybe more fiercely than the government anticipated. I was surprised, for example, in another interview I did from the whole other end of the spectrum from Snowden with former NSA Director Michael Hayden last week, that he suggested that national security might be enhanced more by letting Apple keep its independent encryption than by forcing Apple to break it. Listen, as he says, he's supporting Apple.
The FBI is asking Apple to do things that Apple previously has not done. That may raise constitutional questions. You've got better people to ask that question of than me. I don't think it raises privacy issues. The owner of the phone is dead, and by the way, it wasn't his phone in the first place. Actually, I have my doubts. In fact, I'm trending towards Apple.
Are you surprised that Michael Hayden would take that position, Fred?
No, he's actually been an advocate of privacy and internet security. You know, here's the thing. The NSA for decades has been very keen on leaving or creating backdoors in and other things so that they can hack into the devices used by foreign governments. One thing that they have realized over the years and even a little bit decades is that if you leave a backdoor for the NSA to get into, other people can get into it too, other bad guys. And our government uses these same systems. And so the NSA has kind of been trending, and using a word that Michael Hayden did, toward putting more emphasis on security and a little less emphasis on exploiting other vulnerabilities. I think something that Hayden said in another interview was that he thought that in this case, Apple could do what the FBI wanted it to do without writing a whole new operating system. And I've heard the same thing from people in the industry. But it's all kind of moot at this point. The interesting thing about this Israeli firm that has come up and said, hey, we know how to do this, is the 1789 law that the FBI is invoking to call on Apple to help it get into this phone. There is an exemption from it. It says that you can demand a private entity do this if you don't have any other way of doing it. And so now here's this Israeli firm, which is made up, by the way, mainly of retired analysts of Unit 8200, which is Israeli military's cyber unit. They're saying, we know how to do it, and so the FBI has to stand down.
Huh. So I guess they knew.
Can figure out whether.
I guess Congress knew a lot about smartphones in 1789, Ellen.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Very prescient. I just wanted to say there was some reporting about an Israeli firm called Cellebrite that is the one that's come forward. But my sources say it's not them, definitely not them.
Oh, really?
So, really.
Okay, because Harrod said it was them. So who knows? We'll soon find out.
But all this means people can break into our iPhones despite Apple's well-advertised encryption, Ellen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just earlier this week, we reported on a study by Johns Hopkins University where the researchers had discovered a vulnerability or flaw in iMessage, Apple's iMessage encryption. That's the text message application. Mm-hmm. And this was a group of graduate students who were able to find a way to attack iMessage and get encrypted photos and videos. Apple said it's fixing it.
From your iPhones to your neighborhood dam to your online banking access to the New York Stock Exchange, we are in the age of cyber warfare, cybersecurity controversies, cyber cat and mouse, and there's the latest installment. We thank Fred Kaplan from Slate. His new book is Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. And we thank Ellen Nakashima, national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, it's back, a proposal for tolling the East River bridges that don't currently have tolls, congestion pricing for driving in the Manhattan Business District. Will it pass this time in the state legislature? We'll talk to the Manhattan Assemblyman who's proposing it and an expert on the new congestion pricing plan. Stay with us.